What if one conversation could save a life? What if one new process or new product could save a patient from surgical harm? Broadcasting from a hospital basement near you, you are listening to the Beyond Clean podcast, the global voice of sterile processing. Each week we spotlight the best practices, products and people from around the world who are disrupting our profession and helping you fight dirty. Every instrument, every time. Join us as we have the kinds of conversation that matter and give our industry the kind of voice that it deserves. Nyt on aika mennä puhdastakin puhtaammaksi. And now it's time to go beyond clean.
This week on Beyond Clean, we speak with Keith Kobe, Senior Vice President for North America at Nanosonics. Keith Kobe joined Nanosonics in April of 2012, bringing with him more than 25 years of sales experience and healthcare insight. Mr. Kobe started his career as an engineer with GE Healthcare. After 16 years, he went on to the infection prevention world and joined Medivators to develop their direct sales strategies and lead high-performance sales teams for infection prevention technologies in the U.S. and Canada. Mr. Kobe holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Electrical and Electronics Engineering from DeVry University and a Master's degree in Business Administration, Management, and Operations from Keller Graduate School of Management. He was also a captain in the U.S. Army, where he served 13 years in the U.S. Army Chemical Corps. Mr. Kobe has been a member of the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology since 2006. Hank, this one's a good one. We're going to be talking about ultrasound probes, definitely a topic we've barely touched upon so far in the two seasons of Beyond Clean, and this one will wrap up season two.
Yeah, Justin, this is one of those outlier topics that is not necessarily in the normal scope of a sterile processing department, and yet, as the potential subject matter experts at your facility, sterile processing leaders and frontline technicians should be aware of the challenges of processing these probes, but also the new technology that's out there to do so in a safer fashion. And in addition to sterile processing folks, you know, we have a lot of infection control nurses listen to the show, and I think this will be a good opportunity for them maybe to hear about how the landscape in processing these items have changed.
HealthMark has intelligent solutions for your cleaning verification program, including products to measure water temperature, water quality, cleaning efficacy, and directly test for residual soil left on instruments. Find your tools for cleaning verification at hmark.com. There you will learn about our TOSI and SonoCheck that test the performance of mechanical washers as recommended in sterilization standards guidelines. Other products like CartWash Check test for mechanical efficiency and target temperature. The ProCheck 2 can detect residual protein to a very low level. Go to hmark.com today for all of your cleaning verification testing needs. It's 2023 and there's big news for IST. A closed warning letter, a new product launch, and a 10-year anniversary. OneTray IST has a lot to celebrate this year. OneTray's 2006 cleared 48-hour storage claim was acknowledged by the FDA, and the company is pushing forward, offering the total solution for reprocessing. OneTray maximizes reprocessing time. EasyTracks adds flexibility with instrument organization, and their upcoming product, OneCart, a sealed case cart with a smaller footprint and a perfect option for off-site sterilization, completes the total solution. Experience a year of efficiency with OneTray. For more information on the closure of the warning letter, visit OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. That's OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. Otherwise, you can reach out to the company by calling 937-619-0138 or visit OneTray.com/contact.
Joining us now is Keith Kobe, Senior Vice President for North America at Nanosonics. Keith, welcome to Beyond Clean.
Thank you, Justin. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm excited to be here.
Well, we're excited to have you on the show. We haven't done anything topically on ultrasound probes. I know we're looking forward to getting some answers around disinfection. So why don't you start by telling us some of the challenges and the scope of ultrasound disinfection in the United States?
Sure, thank you. So, you know, with the ultrasound probe disinfection in the United States, it's really been a challenge. If you go back really about 20 years or so, it's been under the radar. And in recent developments, there's been a lot of focus on this from various folks like the Joint Commission, but also from a user perspective on the ground. It's very challenging because the probe can be classified under the Spalding classifications as a, you know, semi-critical device in some instances, and that exact same probe can be classified as critical depending on the use. So we see that this is a big challenge for folks trying to stay compliant, not knowing what to do, and really formally there was no real easy automated way to take care of that.
That's right, Keith. And, you know, I think one of the interesting things about this topic in particular is it touches the whole sterile processing conversation. But as you know, the majority of these devices are outside of the perioperative setting. And so that in itself, you know, says that we have devices around the hospital that need a level of disinfection that is now, I guess you could say, decentralized, you know, from the subject matter experts necessarily who do that as a job. So could you speak to maybe some of the complexity of departments who use this and just what challenges that poses?
That's a great area, yeah. And, you know, we do this, a lot of observation, but we really – in a very consultative manner, what we like to do is start off by typically talking with the infection preventionist on site to start at a very high level and ask a very simple question. So where are you doing ultrasound in your, you know, across your IDN or integrated delivery network? You know, many hospitals may own several clinics where they're outpatient clinics or they're doing these procedures in off-site locations, different departments. And, you know, to tell a quick story, you know, was at a very, very large institution in Cleveland and asked the high-level question of, you know, where are you doing ultrasound? And, you know, the infection preventionist had mentioned that we just finished the census, and in fact, we have 700 ultrasound consoles spread throughout their system. And so the next natural progression would be, well, where are these systems located? And let's go take a look. Let's observe. Let's see how they're disinfecting these probes. And of course, and I do this, you know, across the country and also in Canada, and we have the same response. It's a response of being overwhelmed to say, oh my goodness, what's going on in these departments? Are we being compliant? Again, getting back to what we said earlier, the exact same probe that may, in one case, if it's used in these, you know, these intraoperative procedures based on, you know, Earl Spalding's classifications, that's critical and it really should be sterilized. Of course, if sterilization is not possible due to material compatibility and other things, it must be high-level disinfected at a minimum with the sterile sheath. But in the same instance, that probe or that device could be used in another instance where perhaps it's a surface ultrasound. Maybe, you know, it comes in contact with maybe a burn victim, for example. Then, you know, it also should be high-level disinfected. It's classified as a semi-critical device. And then the exact same probe by model and serial number is used maybe for an abdominal scan on intact skin where it's completely fine to do a low-level disinfection on it. So the same exact device can be used three different ways and it's classified in three different manners. So this creates a big challenge. And really the goal is to try to, you know, mistake-proof the process. And how do you do that? Well, again, you know, for decades going back, there was soaking methods that, you know, was manual, that was very prone to human error and mistakes and missteps. So we find ourselves in this big area that we're shining light on, and it's a small niche when you think of the large umbrella of infection prevention within a facility. They've got big, big problems to handle, and this is a small niche, but we want to shine light on this area.
So Keith, kind of along that train of thought that we just started following, what are those, you know, infection risks that are associated with these particular probes? I know that often, you know, from clinicians, when we follow things like the Spalding system, that those things that fall under that semi-critical range, oftentimes they kind of look at it and say, well, you know, it's a non-sterile procedure and a non-sterile body cavity. What's the worst that could happen? And that was kind of the predominant attitude, you know, even among the GI scopes. And then we had, you know, several outbreaks, several people died from these things. And, you know, but I don't think anybody was really aware of that infection risk. So what is the infection risk related to these ultrasound probes?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And you know, the evidence around this area is growing. You know, in recent years, in recent history, you know, when I started 7 years ago in this small niche here with Nanosonics, it was relatively undocumented. You know, it's like, yeah, it makes sense that the probe handle could be contaminated because, you know, the sonographers using that probe again and again and again, and the old soaking methods did not, you know, disinfect the handle. So surely that handle's filthy, but there was no evidence. So now there's been studies and the evidence, the fundamentals around this area are growing. And so we find ourselves with, you know, documented cases where like 12.9% of probes were contaminated with pathogenic bacteria following routine disinfection. Again, that was peer-reviewed, validated, published, and so forth. And that was after routine disinfection. In other cases, you know, and the big hot topic since really 2014 or so had been around HPV, where Professor Meyer out of Penn State had done, you know, his life's work around on HPV. And the next natural progression was, well, what disinfectants are going to be deactivating HPV, particularly the strains that we care about, you know, the ones that cause, say, cervical cancer, 16, 18, 32, et cetera. You know, and he found that, oh my goodness, you know, some of the routine disinfectants that found in his own hospital was not deactivating it even after soaking for up to 48 hours. So we, you know, the evidence has been building. You've got, you know, potential HPV, you've got other pathogenic bacteria following routine disinfection on the handle. You know, we even found things like MRSA, residual pathogens on the handle, particularly on the probes again that were not being disinfected. So it's a very serious area that we feel that we can do better, you know, as a healthcare system, just by focusing on this area, we can do better.
Now, you mentioned the traditional disinfectants, you know, maybe not working on certain pathogens, but I want to kind of steer us toward another question related to the traditional disinfecting methods out there, and that's chemical safety. Mm-hmm. And anytime that you're utilizing that type of soaking method, you know, you've got chemicals out in the workspace. And I know, and anyone who has done this job before, there's always questions on, is there the right air exhaust going in? Like, do we have the right pressure here? You know, what's the mixture rate? Can you go through maybe some of those safety-related issues?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, this is an area, again, that, you know, early on, I'm just a curious, you know, recovering electronics engineer, you know, into the infection prevention world, and I'm curious. And so early on, we developed just basic, what we called a walkthrough. And it was, you know, again, go around the blank sheet of paper, help the infection preventionist just uncover these areas where there might be some compliance challenges. And one of them, obviously, is the safety of the liquid disinfection. Like you said, there's PPE requirements, there's all kinds of areas of ventilation. And as I started going around and visited literally hundreds of sites in the last few years, I have not found many that had the proper ventilation. And some of that was due to this ultrasound probe disinfection niche that I'm talking about is, you know, typically done in maybe a utility closet in the hallway. It was, again, done not as rigidly as like a central processing, medical device reprocessing, central sterile area. It was done, you know, on the department floor in radiology or in a closet down the hall from a women's care center. And so when I go into those areas, you know, I've been around it so much, I can tell right away, is there 10 air exchanges an hour? No. You know, sometimes you could do a quick check, you know, put a tissue up on the exhaust and you see there's no airflow. You even ask some questions. Have you ever had your air tested? Is the flow correct? And of course, you know, that's a grave concern. The labels say that you need to have that for a reason, and it's to protect patients and their staff from being around those vapors. And sad case, I met an infection preventionist in Mississippi who had been around this for many, many years and actually had essentially lost part of her lung based on the years and years of inhaling the vapor. So, you know, it's a serious situation that I think compliance makes a difference, and it's something to be looked at. You know, there's a lot of other areas in this arena that can cause some issues too, not just the ventilation.
So along that line of thought then, you know, this is very reminiscent of a episode that we did back in season one with David Hilliker regarding, you know, that chemical vapor monitoring system and how critical that was to the well-being of those healthcare professionals that are exposed to it every day. Do the automated systems then, do they help drive the compliance? Do they help the clinicians and the reprocessing technicians, you know, handle these kinds of challenges?
That's a great question, and indeed they do. The automated system that is in our catalog, the Trophon EPR and the Trophon 2, they're completely sealed, and they use they shifted away from aldehyde, you know, and orthoaldehyde, and used hydrogen peroxide. So H2O2 breaks down into water and oxygen. The thresholds for that are much, much lower, and it's a completely sealed device. So the user, the operator, the patient, the environment's never contacted directly with the chemical. It's a sealed cartridge, and the machine is sealed as well. So there's no exposure there. And that in and of itself then opens up the door for things that the technology has really leapfrogged some guidelines in. So for instance, you know, the directions for use in the Trophon will say you can place it in the exam room in a patient care area. Why? Because again, it's sealed. There's no exhaust, if you will. And so that put a lot of people on their head, like going, well, you know, the CDC guidelines from 2008 say, you know, you really shouldn't do any high-level disinfection in a patient area. However, this has changed that paradigm because, again, the technology has leapfrogged the guidelines. And so we tell customers to do their own risk assessment, knowing what they know, and make their own call. We never, you know, force anybody like that, but it's a new era. And this automation helps be, you know, compliant, but also helps protect your, you know, patient and staff from these vapors.
Keith, I know you mentioned this at the beginning of the show, but I want to go back to it again. The distinctions between the external probes and the internal probes, and you know, really speak to question on, is there a different standard of care? And obviously, folks, you know, who have these units and who process these units, if you read the IFUs for the devices, it would appear to say, yes, the internal probes, obviously, you know, clearly high-level disinfection, and then, as you reference, you know, depending on the use, it can get complex real quick for those external devices. But is it just safer to, if you have the ability to high-level disinfect, to keep it one standard of care for all the devices?
You know, that's a very good question. Again, from a workflow perspective, absolutely. It makes a lot of sense. And we have many, many customers that are standardizing that way because you want to make it error-free, and I call it poke-yoke the process, so you cannot make a mistake. And the best way to do that is to have a solid process. And one of the nice things is the device is compatible with all major OEMs. We've done, my gosh, our compatibility testing program is very robust. We run thousands of cycles on the probe. We send it back to the OEM. We get the validation back from them saying it's indeed compatible, and then we add it to our list of compatible probes. And so this list has grown now. There's well over 1,000. I think it's even beyond that number, and it's growing every year as they come out with new probes. So that makes it easier. It takes the guesswork out. The famous paper from Corey Ofsted, you know, that said even under observation, reprocessing manually, I think only like 1.4% of the time, the folks actually check the box on all the correct manual steps. So we remove that using the automated process. And you know, frankly, too, if it's easy and it's a one or two button press after you've cleaned the probe, you know, why would you not? Why would you cut a corner just for the health of the community, if nothing else? So, yeah, we look at this area a lot, and we really want to automate the workflow and make it easy, make it almost like second nature, that you just, you know, this is part of the flow. And that's one of the reasons why we would place the devices closer to the point of care. And so where those procedures are being done, and because there's it's designed to be used there and there's no vapors, then it really streamlines the workflow.
So, Keith, as you mentioned at the beginning, you know, this has become sort of a focus of regulatory bodies such as the Joint Commission And, you know, this has actually happened to me twice, that hospitals I was at had Joint Commission inspections, and all of a sudden I just get a call out of nowhere in my department, and they say, hey, Joint Commission is down here asking some stuff about, you know, ultrasound probes and their storage. Can you come down here and answer questions for us? And I'm like, I have no idea what you're even talking about. But, you know, they look at us as, you know, the experts when it comes to, you know, sterilization, high level disinfection, and they're in a desperate spot, and they call you in to the rescue. So can you go over with us, you know, some of those common myths and misunderstandings about the, particularly the storage, so that when the SPD staff who inevitably get this phone call and have to come up with something on the fly, what are the things that they need to be looking for in order to, you know, come in and be the hero?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And you know, what we say is that the wheel of life for these probes is to clean, disinfect, and store the probe in those three steps. And so the cleaning step is obviously very, very important. If you go to high-level disinfect a dirty probe that's got bioburden and gel and dried blood on it, it's not going to be done properly. So those two steps are critical. But on the storage side, as you mentioned, that also is a critical piece. And in my travels early on, and I'm not picking on the state of Arkansas here, but I was in Arkansas at a hospital to be named, and I walked in.
I bet you it was Mike's.
Was it my hospital?
I bet you it was Mike's.
But I walked in, and we met with the infection preventionist and went through the department, and in the ultrasound area, like I mentioned, we go through, you know, blank sheet of paper, kind of, where are you doing ultrasound? I saw next to the console with the probes, with brown paper lunch bags on the probe. And I just was curious again. I said, so what does this mean? And she said, well, those are clean probes ready to be used. I said, we can do better, you know, and thinking to myself. So we now have what we call the clean covers, and they go on the probe following high-level disinfection with a printed label that will give the operator the disinfection cycle, date and time. So now we know that the probe has been cleaned, and of course, even the branding on the actual cover says clean cover, and it gives the patient assurance when they're sitting in the exam room ready to undergo an ultrasound, when they see the operator remove a clean cover that actually says clean cover on it. So that's a step in the right direction. But, you know, probes from their directions for use will say, you know, store in a manner that's accessible, dry, and keeps it from any further contamination. So we've seen things like HEPA cabinets, things like that. Those are all very good compliance-wise. The clean covers are very good to use following HLD. And we don't know sometimes how often that probe is used. Some centers very, very busy. They're using the probe so fast. But there's other ones that will sit there for a couple days, perhaps. And so those are the ones that you want to keep the probe clean. I have seen other areas that I walk into where the probes are literally stacked up on a shelf, laying horizontally. We don't know if they're clean or dirty. And, of course, you can imagine in a busy scenario where there's a spike and they need a probe, the operator may come in and grab that probe, and they don't know if it's clean or dirty. So we want to distinguish between clean and dirty when we're storing and transporting.
So kind of last question regarding those sort of inspections. You know, one thing that Joint Commission will always, you know, kind of zone in on is the need for eyewash stations. And, of course, if there was an open container, you know, there would be a very definite need for an eyewash station. For the, you know, closed automated system such as yours, is there still a need for eyewash stations?
Excellent question. And I think I've gotten this question. I got a lot more several years ago when our product was newer, because there was, you know, like you said, I go back, you know, for decades, the only solution out there was this manual soaking method. So you had open containers, you had soaking vats, you had you had to drain and fill, you had to neutralize, and you had to refill these with, you know, open jugs, gallon jugs. With the Trophon EPR, you know, and Trophon 2, the cartridge is sealed. So We have a position on this, and we have what we call customer information notice, but we went through it and really dug into the OSHA area. And OSHA has, you know, very, you know, I hate to say it, but vague guidance, but it does say some things that we were able to pull out, or things like, you know, they say, like, if hazardous materials are present at a work site in a way that will ensure that exposure cannot occur, then an eyewash or emergency shower would not be necessary. So we kind of took that and said, okay, let's look at our Sonics bottle. Let's look at the way that's done. It's got a Kevlar vent. It's sealed. It doesn't get punctured until it's inside the machine, which is sealed. So the likelihood is very low to have any kind of exposure. Now, that would be in a normal operating environment. Take it into a warehouse where perhaps there's forklifts running around, you know, that could run over a box, or a box can fall, then get run over. I would say you need an eyewash station. And so we conclude by saying, let's do your own interpretation and risk assessment. Each customer would have to do that based on that knowledge, based on the knowledge of the new device, and based on, you know, the OSHA guidelines. So we've seen a large number of customers say, you know what? We used to soak. We have the soaking station. We have an eyewash station. We might as well keep that eyewash station in the hallway or wherever it is. But, you know, that's kind of where we see it today with the Trophon and how that's being deployed.
Excellent, Keith. It's amazing, but the time just flies by on these interviews every single time. You're very concise, though, and I think you communicated the message perfectly. So I wanted to thank you for coming on the show. And we say it often when we wrap certain episodes to the guest that I'm sure we'll have you on again on a future episode. You did a really nice job, and I wanted to thank you for sharing your knowledge with our listeners today.
Thank you very much, Justin and Hank. It's been my pleasure, and looking forward to talking with you all in the future.
That was Keith Kobe, Senior Vice President for North America at Nanosonics. And, Mike, this was a great one. I was a big fan of David Hilliker's episode, especially on exposure. I just felt like that's an area of focus that has not been emphasized nearly to the degree of risk that is out there in the sterile processing world. And so this one kind of ties to that. And also, as it relates to Joint Commission readiness, going back a little bit of throwback to Jenny Mandarino and Barbara Harmer's episodes here on Beyond Clean. But I think this episode really covers an area that maybe it just doesn't get that much focus day to day either. So I love it when we bring a topic to the listeners that maybe they're just not thinking about every single day.
Yeah, and that's typically how these things, you know, shake out. Like I mentioned, you know, this has actually happened to me twice where the Joint Commission was at the hospital and, you know, you get a panic phone call from radiology that says, hey, you know, come help us out. And that's a tremendous opportunity for sterile processing professionals, especially the managers, to be ready on the front end with solutions and answers that can really break you out from just being in the OR to really having a dramatic impact throughout the hospital and throughout those patient care areas. So it's a great opportunity to know these things ahead of time so that you can really, you know, establish yourself as that subject matter expert.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's show. As a reminder, you can help support us by subscribing to Beyond Clean on iTunes or Stitcher, and now also on Google Play and Spotify. Simply search for Beyond Clean Podcast. We'd appreciate a rating and a review because your feedback is important. If you have any topics that you'd like us to cover on a future episode, or if you'd like to share a picture anonymously on our Instagram page, just send an email to info@beyondclean.net. On behalf of Hank, Mike, and myself, thank you for listening to another edition of Beyond Clean.